Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 135 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Retired, Not Forgotten, Jim Root Disease Cook. No, his middle name isn't root disease, but given the 40 years Jim Cook's dedicated himself to the subject of studying the pathogens that attack wheat roots, I'm honoring him with a new and descriptive middle name. It's sad to think that many in my listening audience may not know who Jim Cook is, as he's been retired now from Washington State University and the Agricultural Research Service for 15 years. The scientific papers he authored referred to him as R.J. Cook, which is also the official name of the agronomy farm that bears his name. To other scientists, farmers, and even newspaper reporters, however, he was always Jim. Cook worked for the Agricultural Research Service for most of his career, the arc of which he'll describe ahead. That included 2 years serving as interim dean of the College of Agriculture, Human, and Natural Resource Sciences at WSU. I don't remember our first meeting, but I'm certain it must have happened 30 or so years ago at a USDA conservation farm field day outside of Pullman. That was right around the time Cook and other scientists were figuring out the phenomenon known as the Green Bridge, specifically how growing plants, including volunteer wheat, can reinfect subsequent crops with root disease. We'll talk about the Green Bridge ahead, research that I think continues to resonate for today's farmers. Cook retired in 2005 and has spent much of the time since then volunteering in various capacities with scientific societies. I visited Cook and his wife Bev at their lovely home on Lake Coeur d'Alene June 21, 2019. Cook and I sat on stools at a counter across from each other as the lake glittered outside the windows. Cook was not just an important scientist back in the day, but a great communicator, which is why I knew I'd get a good answer from him by asking the simplest of questions. What are we talking about when we're talking about root diseases?
To make a long story short, today we know that there are 4 different root diseases of wheat. And I'll kind of follow them in the order in which they attacked a wheat plant. First is Pythium, which was unknown to wheat when I started my program. And Pythium loves the youngest tissue on the wheat plant. That means the fine rootlets. It nibbles off root hairs, the very parts of the root system that should reach out and get the nutrients is what it strips away. It also attacks the seed as it's germinating in the soil, but we stop that with a seed treatment. But we can't stop the root diseases with a seed treatment. The only way we can deal with it is to fumigate the soil. And, of course, I did a lot of that just to prove what was going on, but never intended it to be anything the farmers would do. Then next is Rhizoctonia. And it girdles the roots. And it starts pretty close to the soil surface. I'd like to say it's just like a beaver chews off a tree and you have a spear point, just a pointed little. That's the stub of the root, that's what's left. The rest of the root is hopeless, lost in the soil. Then there is the classic, the best known of all, which is Takol. And Takol can be so subtle as to just infect the crown where the tillers are attached to the main stem and plug up that part of the plant so water can't get to the tops. It can also, under really good moisture conditions or irrigation, it goes all the way down the roots and up into the stem, into the tillers. And then there's the one that I worked on first when I got here because there was a major outbreak of Fusarium crown rot. And there's actually 2 species of Fusarium. One is Fusarium culmorum, which I worked on, and the other is Fusarium graminearum. And by the way, there's a very nice article in the latest issue of Wheat Life by Tim Politz and Kim Campbell on resistance that they're finding to the Fusarium crown rot, which is also caused by Fusarium pseudograminearum, so 2 species. So that's the 4, Pythium, Rhizoctonia, Takol, and Fusarium.
I'm fascinated by the reduction of the pH because of our application of fertilizers. Do any of these diseases that you just mentioned thrive on lower pH?
Pythium. I had a graduate student who worked out a beautiful study, And Pythium likes low pH and high clay soils. And so that's Spokane County in particular. Now, Tacol is just the opposite. It likes alkaline soils. So if we ever get really serious about liming our soils to counteract the low pH problem from years of fertilizer use, look out, because whenever lime has been applied to the soil, and that's especially true in western Washington, where the soils are naturally acid and they did a lot of liming, and that's when Tacol really kicked in. Fusarium likes acid soils. So as we lime soils, it may or may not be less of a problem.
Interesting.
Jim, one of the things that I most closely associate with you is the Green Bridge and the work toward identifying what's going on in that interval between the end of a crop year and the beginning and the planting of a new crop. Talk to me about the Green Bridge and how you came to understand it and then communicated that to growers.
Well, that definitely was one of the highlights of my career, but it wasn't only me. The first publication on that was Dick Smiley in Oregon, and ARS weed scientist, now retired, Alex Ogg, and I put that story together. But we also had communication with a good friend in Australia, where they were onto the same thing that we were onto back in the 90s and even before that. So that's really an interesting story, because as the early no-tillers will remember, before we had combines that could really spread the straw, we would see spring wheat no-tills planted into winter wheat stubble, and you could see every combine row as stunting and green when the rest of the crop in between the combine rows were ripening nicely. And the explanation was, out of soil science, is that the straw was toxic in the combine row, and they said the chaff is really toxic. Well, there's never any evidence for that. All the time, it was not the straw, it was the green-up in that stubble. And that's so much the way science works. You think you've got it figured out, and suddenly the answer was right there under your nose the whole time.
But now, isn't the straw a component of the problem then?
No. Well, it is indirectly. Let me explain. So green-up is the seed that gets kicked out from the back of the combine, a shriveled seed, but it still can germinate. So the stubble will get a uniform stand of volunteer wheat. So what was happening, farmers were waiting until that green-up really got along before they would plant, get as much of a green-up as they could, and then spray it with Roundup. It turns out that you need to spray at least 2 weeks, and better yet, a month before you're going to plant, so that that green-up is totally dead. Because what was happening, Rhizoctonia in particular, was growing on the roots of that volunteer wheat and producing those spear tips and establishing a food base. And so now when the new wheat is drilled into that unsanitary situation, the Rhizoctonia went directly from the food base that it had created for itself, attacking the volunteer, directly onto the new wheat that's now been seeded as part of the next crop. So what we learned was, spray it with Roundup, yes, but then you've got to allow for that plant to totally die and for the decomposers to move in on the food base that Rhizoctonia had established for itself. And that took a while. And now if it's a nice fall and there's good moisture before seeding, the job is going to be pretty well complete. But if there's any green-up that's not fully decomposed and overtaken by the regular decomposers in soil, that Rhizoctonia will go directly from those decaying roots right onto the roots of the new crop. And that was what was going on in the combine row. And it was causing the wheat to be stunted. And like I say, it was thought to be due to the straw. Now, where the straw comes in is it keeps the soil under the straw cool and moist. And that favors both Rhizoctonia and Pythium. They like it cool and moist. So the straw was like a wet blanket to hold the moisture in. So there's two things going on, one direct in the food base and the other indirect in providing the right environment for the Rhizoctonia to move from the dying roots of the volunteer onto the new roots of the newly seeded crop.
Mm-hmm. Who came up with the term green bridge?
Well, I'm not sure. It could have been Roger Beeseth. Roger worked a lot on that before he lost his life, and we did a lot of work together. I really don't know where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I invented it, but I'll take credit for it.
Well, it's a good description. It is very
good description. Yes, absolutely. It says it all.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, as we're talking here, and we're talking about straw, how do you feel about all of this baling of wheat straw off of fields to supply the pulp plant down near Walla Walla?
We have enough straw left over to provide something for the paper mills. But definitely, as we move out of the 15 to 18 inch rainfall zone, that straw belongs in the field. And I think that's pretty much, and not to be burned either, although when we burn it, we, of course, lose the potential for holding that soil from blowing away or washing away. But there is enough straw in the high production area, although I don't think economically it's ever worked out. So the problem kind of took care of itself. Mm-hmm. Economics just wasn't there to bale that straw and haul it away
mm-hmm.
for paper.
You mean in the area below 15 inches?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the big deals in human health and also in plant health within the last 5-7 years is the word called the biome. The human biome, it's the microorganisms that exist on our bodies and within our bodies, particularly in our intestines, and the plant biome is the microorganisms that exist around the roots of the plant. I'm curious, over the years, I've certainly heard you talk about lots of microorganisms in the soil. Were you dealing with the plant biome before it had a name?
I was. In fact, plant pathology and plant biology, microbiology or plant microbiology, has been dealing with what is now called the microbiome, or the biome, for a long time, long before it became popular in human health. My first two books with a professor at Berkeley, both on biological control of plant pathogens, were dealing with the microbiome, the organisms that multiply around the roots in response to the nutrients that leak out of the roots. Also the microorganisms that are on the leaves, there's whole communities. And just like cities tend to build up around rivers and streams and so forth, that's where the microorganisms are too, along the veins of the leaves. And wherever there's going to be cracks for nutrients to leak out, that's where they grow. But what I got into was the benefit of these organisms defending the plant against root disease. And what we call suppressive soils, where there'd be a microbiome buildup in response to cropping with organisms that make antibiotics. And those antibiotics defend that root against infection. And that's where we got into one of the most exciting projects that's still ongoing. It's been going on now for 30 years to understand how the soil becomes immune to take-all if you just keep growing wheat in that soil.
Which is totally counterintuitive.
Exactly. That's why it didn't get looked at. Nobody believed that that was actually what was going on. And there's a whole story behind how I got into that. But we now know that there are very specific microbacteria that multiply in the small lesions that the take-all fungus produces, and they're going to grow bigger, except these bacteria, kind of like secondaries, get into the wounds created by the infection, the lesions, and make an antibiotic that arrests the continued growth of that fungus. So today, we see in the high rainfall area of eastern Washington and northern Idaho, wheat, 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 wheat. And in fact, if you rotate more than 2 years out of wheat, that suppressiveness is lost and it has to be regenerated by monoculture wheat. And I'm so fascinated because wheat evolved as a monoculture. It grew, it's reseeded itself in the same place every year without tillage. And that's what's basically happening now in the wheat industry. And I just marvel as I drive north on Highway 195 and look out the window and see wheat on both sides of the road, and high-yielding wheat, too, although there's still more yield to be had because it's not totally immune from the disease and from still pythium and rhizoctonia and so forth.
So you're telling me that this wheat after wheat that we're seeing out here in commercial fields, that there is that take-all antibiotic.
That's right. And Dave Weller, who I hired as a postdoc in 1978 and is still at Pullman, and Linda Tomashaw, who joined him in the mid-80s, have worked all of that out. And they've got gene probes that can identify exactly the right organisms and how they're and what kind of populations they represent. And they represent something like maybe 5 million colony-forming units per gram of soil around the roots, which is a horrendous population. But as soon as you break that cycle, they subside and different ones take their place, and then you've got to start it over again. But it's just, I also think when I'm walking in a wheat field, I'm walking on soil that's got organisms in it that's generating antibiotics that are protecting the roots of this crop. They're quite a resource.
But Jim, all of my career, it's been about rotation, rotation, rotation. Farmers have got to rotate their crops. I mean, in direct seeding, rotation is very important. And what you're telling me now is, well, maybe not.
Well, rotation is important for weed control. And the rotation that I worked with was not continuous winter wheat, but winter wheat, spring wheat. And up in Lincoln County, they have a very successful rotation of winter wheat, spring wheat, and then a year of fallow. In my research on the Cook Farm and on the Pluse Conservation Field Station, I had ongoing trials for 10 to 15 years that was winter wheat, spring wheat, winter wheat, spring wheat. And that gives you an option for weed control. Continuous winter wheat will get you into cheatgrass. And absolutely, continuous winter wheat is not what I'm talking about. It's that rotation.
What is your advice to farmers out there? I mean, should we not be looking so closely at rotations? Are you suggesting that we might just be better off with this spring and winter wheat rotation?
Well, yes and no. Obviously, I think inserting a lentil crop or garbanzos or canola is a good thing to do, but not overextending that part of the rotation. But just backing up a little bit, continuous wheat is one of the only ways we have to increase the land area planted to wheat for food production without more land. So rather than grow wheat in the same field once every third year, how about growing it 2 years out of three? Or even continuous wheat, but again, breaking the weed cycle with winter wheat, spring wheat. It's very successful, and farmers are making it work. And they're doing it with no-till. And in what I've really referred to over and over again is the cereal-intensive cropping systems. And throw in barley, too, which actually is a good way to help reduce the pressure from take-all without losing take-all decline, the suppressiveness or immunity of the soil. Yes, I think that's where we're headed. That's where we're at. And you only have to look out the window as you drive north from Pullman to Spokane and even west on Highway 2 to see that farmers are making it work. Now, there's still a yield, there's an unrealized yield potential due to root disease. And take-all is not one of them as much as it would have been. There's still the rhizoctonia and the pythium that we have to deal with. Now, one of the things that was hard for me to demonstrate to growers when they look at a wheat crop and it looks perfectly healthy is, how do I know that I've got root disease? And way early in my career, I brought in soil fumigation as a research tool. Now, you can walk into a field and see the weeds. You can see the rust, but you can't see the root disease. And so that's where I brought in soil fumigation and made it an integral part of my field research already back in the late 70s and early 80s. And there we looked. So now I'm going to back up a little bit and say there's still this unrealized yield potential due to the pythium and rhizoctonia. So when I brought in soil fumigation, we looked at the wheat in the non-fumigated plots. Well, that looks normal. It's pretty healthy looking. How do I know it's got root disease? Until you see what the wheat's going to look like where we treat the soil with methylbromide under a clear plastic tarp. And I'd had a methylbromide treatment in every one of my field trials for about 25 years. And it's spectacular. And growers will remember if they were at the field day when I spoke to demonstrate what healthy wheat is supposed to look like. So, yes, we've got Taycol kind of up against the ropes due to their antibiotic-producing bacteria. But now what I'm finding is that as Taycol goes into decline, Rhizoctonia takes its place. And Pythium is there all the time as well. I can tell you, Scott, that if we ever had the level of resistance in wheat to Rhizoctonia that we have for the rust and for Cercospirella foot rot, farmers are going to be blown away, having made this big case about how good the wheat is thanks to the immunity of the soil to Taycol. There is still another 10 to 15% that we're not getting because of Rhizoctonia.
What about seed treatments? I mean, seed treatments have been almost magic. Is it possible that there will be a seed treatment against Rhizoctonia?
Well, I did a lot of work with the fungicide called Dividend. But there is another example of what I just talked about. I discovered the chemical that's used to control Pythium. What happens there when you control Pythium around the seed and the young rootlets that are coming out, Rhizoctonia takes its place. Just like it does, again, with Taycol decline, Rhizoctonia moves in. We had to combine Apron with Dividend to control the Rhizoctonia. But again, it's only protecting the germinating seed. And you get a nice healthy seedling from that, but it doesn't move systemically down to protect the roots. They're still fully vulnerable to both Pythium and Rhizoctonia infections. So I did so much work on seed treatments. I also did a lot of work going after these antibiotic-producing bacteria with Dave Weller. We ran 20 years of field tests with antibiotic-producing bacteria dressed on the seed, expected to go down the advancing root tip as the roots move into the soil, and we got some really nice results from that. But that would require, it's a biopesticide, and that has to be treated like a chemical pesticide, and there's enough variability in it that nobody wanted to take it up as a product and market it. So we're depending on Mother Nature to generate the suppressiveness with continuous wheat, as opposed to trying to introduce it as a seed treatment. But there's no question that the seed treatments have been key to good stand establishment, nice, vigorous young seedlings. And after that, the root diseases, of course, are going to continue to operate almost as if nothing had been put on the seed. But that seedling vigor is so important to get that plant off to a good start and get those first two or three tillers to form on schedule and compete with the main stem, which, of course, is where we get our yield potential.
It's easy to concentrate on Cook's scientific career because there's so much to talk about. But I'd be negligent not to mention he's a farm boy, the oldest of eight children who grew up on a 400-acre farm in Minnesota. Although I've interviewed plenty of excellent agricultural scientists who have no connection to a farm, I think the fact that Cook grew up on one, thinking for a time he'd become a farmer himself, helped create the bond that existed with those in the field he made it his life's work to help. I hope you've enjoyed episode 135, or what I entitled, Retired, Not Forgotten, Jim Root Disease Cook. The first part of my conversation with the winner of numerous prizes and awards for his outstanding scientific contributions to agriculture. Please join me for the second part of my conversation when Cook and I will talk about his relationship with Orville Vogel, the developer of semi-dwarf wheat, as well as his thoughts about glyphosate. Not to mention how he wound up as interim dean of the College of Agriculture after a career spent avoiding administration. All that and more next week on Wheat All About It!
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just salvation in times of want and woe. Least has been our savior, our grub, our cool, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat. But there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.